Justified anger and black like me, it's Busted Pencils, and we have the Reverend Dr. Alex G.
This is Busted Pencils Radio, fully leaded education talk with Dr. Tim Slecker. Here's what's trending in education news.
From USAtoday.com, Trump's education freedom plan is an attack on public schools. That's un-American. Trump and DeVos are peddling a dangerous vision of private education and an individual freedom that undermines a fundamental pillar of our democracy.
But it's freedom, Bonnie. And you know who likes freedom. America loves freedom. Remember? I mean, we were into freedom that we even called our French fries freedom fries right. for a while. Okay. Don't be messing with America and their freedoms. Okay. Okay. Word flipping choicing here. What's actually happening is a quote freedom plan is how do we take words and use words to excite people to think we mean one thing, but actually push something forward that they won't like. This freedom plan is actually saying we would like to end public schooling and Bonnie allow you the freedom to take tax dollars and spend them at any private school of your choice. Or has there really known vouchers?
Okay? Oh, okay.
Okay. So yep. this is a voucher plan put, it's with the lipstick on a pig. Mm-hmm. Instead of saying Bonnie gets a voucher, we're giving you
freedom
to be yeah. educated. Because at the other word twist in this article, at government schools, right? Mm-hmm. Like, wait.
There's government schools?
There's government. Or, no, there's public schools. But if you don't want people getting upset, because, see, people like public schools. So if you say public schools, people are like, well, I kind of like my public school. And it's like 85% support for it.
Yeah.
Say government schools, guess what?
Then it's bad.
Instant hatred. Mm-hmm. Okay? Because I don't like government.
Right.
At all. Especially during the snow season when the plow comes by and plows me out so I can drive. I hate government programs.
Right.
Like snow plowing. Okay, and public schooling is really just government schooling. But no, this is not freedom. This is just, again, Trump and DeVos using language to excite their base to hide the fact that what they want to do is defund public schooling and put more money into vouchers so that students can leave public schools going to private schools. Some people say, well, what's wrong with that, Tim? Well, it then puts in place a monetary collapse of your local public schools. And that goes back to, guess what? 85% of the people like their public schools. And even Republicans send their kids to public schools.
From thehill.com, Trump budget proposes ending public service student loan forgiveness program. The Trump administration seeks to end the popular public service loan forgiveness program, which allows government workers, Native American tribal employees, and nonprofit workers to earn forgiveness of their student debt.
And we want to get rid of that because getting rid of a loan forgiveness program which workers earn
is bad.
Is a bad thing.
Yep.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. This is absolute silliness because as you first pointed out, though, when we talked about this, you're like, I didn't even know there was such a thing.
I read this and I was like, wait, why didn't I sign up for this?
I missed out.
I'm in radio. That's nonprofit.
My goodness. How am I?
Sorry,
it's the whole part though. First of all, this is this thing. It's an interestingly unique program that was put together.
Yes.
That and forgiveness is probably not the best way to label it because it automatically then communicates to people. Oh, so you took out your student loan and now the government's bailing you out and you don't have to pay back, you freeloader.
That's exactly how I read this,
right,
though.
Right.
When I was like, there's a loan forgiveness program for people who are government. You know, that's how I read it.
Exactly. And so it comes across. And so why is Trump getting rid of it? Because it doesn't sound like a Trump thing to be forgiving people's mm-hmm. student loans. That's not what we do in the Trump administration.
Right.
Okay. We forgive Amazon. We forgive You name what other corporation, but we're not going to forgive individual students for going to school and contributing their tax dollars back into the economy. I'm sorry, I digress, as they say. But no, this is actually a commitment over a 10-year period to pay back a pretty substantial portion of the loan. If during that 10-year period you make all of your payments, and I actually explored this, it actually elevated my payments to a point where I was like, okay, I can't afford to have my loans forgiven.
Because this can't happen
because over 10 years I don't have that amount of money to pay a month, because that's what they do. They up the amount of money. But after a 10-year period, if there's a balance left, then you're forgiven. So it's not that I show up, I'm sad, I got a worthless literature degree, I got $150,000 in debt, I work for a nonprofit, can the government bail me out? That's not what was happening here. But symbolically, what Trump did here was say, we are ending student loan forgiveness. And for Bonnie, who didn't know this exists out there, you went, thank God, because my stuff wasn't forgiven.
Right.
And it should never happen to anybody else either.
From Sharesplosion.com, Texas school announced it will bring back paddling for misbehaving kids.
And the dateline on this is... actually, 2020.
They've just missed it so much that they're bringing it back.
They're on the cutting edge of disciplinary techniques.
Right.
I mean, long ago, things were good. And you know when that was? Is when people were being paddled.
Right.
Okay. Take away the paddle and discipline in schools has gone to hell.
It has, totally.
What are you supposed to do with that? Cutting edge, this is a bit horrifying in one way, because I will testify to having been in school during the days of corporal punishment and having experienced corporal punishment.
Right.
And as I was telling you earlier, I did not go back to my classroom and think about the wrong I did and felt bad about it. I went back in pain, angry, and was ready to take out something else.
Right, exactly.
Okay.
It didn't adjust your attitude?
It did not adjust my attitude. My behavior was not fixed at all. And I just was more careful not to get caught next time.
Right. Well, you got to learn something.
No, but here's another sad part of the serious story, though, behind this is that actually it does contribute to continued abusiveness in the future for children that are typically paddled more. So again, own anecdotal story, but friend in kindergarten through all the way through school who was paddled regularly. Yes.
Wait, regularly?
Regularly. Leg bouncing at his desk afterwards with small tears, but he wasn't going to show them to you in second grade. By 20, was then arrested for killing a prostitute with a beer bottle. So I'm pretty sure that the paddling that this child experienced from the age of 6 all the way through school didn't help him turn out well.
You don't think it changed his behavior and outlook on life?
Maybe it changed it, but we don't know how. But this is the kind of insanity. And you would say, only in Texas would they say, hey, let's bring out a piece of wood with a handle on it and start whacking the behinds of kids, because there was a day when it worked. Because that's what's behind the movement here is that's what they did to me.
It used to be fine. Now we just do it in college. Yeah.
And that's a whole different thing. And we will not admit that it happened in college, because that would be admitting that we went through hazing.
Yeah, we didn't do that. Okay.
But no hazing. Texas, put the paddles away.
We are Busting Pencils!
He is the lead pastor of Fountain of Life Covenant Church, a multiracial, multigenerational, and multi-class congregation in Madison, Wisconsin. He also pioneered the Nehemiah Center for Urban Leadership Development, a nonprofit organization that inspires, develops, and mobilizes emerging African American leaders to become partners in revitalizing and transforming communities, Most recently, he has nudged his local community to rethink racial disparities in Madison, Wisconsin, by launching an incredible citywide movement called Justified Anger. This movement has gained national attention. He also has recent efforts that have created historic gatherings and have gathered over 1,000 non-black allies into the community. He is also the host of the podcast, Black Like Me. Welcome to Busted Pencils, Reverend Dr. Alex G. Man.
Man, Dr. Slacker, it's good to be here. Thank you for finally inviting me.
Well, finally inviting you. It's just finally how we can make our schedules work together. I've been trying
I had to just get that zinger in first.
So it's Alex and Tim from now
yes,
on, right?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
So, Alex, all of this work, I mean, I've been in Madison since 2013, is right when you launched and wrote that Justified Anger piece.
That's right. I met you right after that.
Right after that. I mean, I'm right into it. Has the racial disparity or racial harmony, whatever you want to say it, has the needle moved since 2013 in Madison?
Oh, definitely. Backwards.
Backwards.
Well, you know, Tim, it's like when you want to clean out that junky drawer or closet, it gets crazy. You know, you're halfway through cleaning it out. You bring all the stuff out and you think, why did I even start this project? This is worse than when it was just shoved into this drawer. Race relations is like that.
Okay.
Madison's been on this crash course for decades. We can find articles going back to the 1920s stating that Madison had a Negro problem and folks weren't finding work. So it doesn't happen because a couple of people come together, write a paper, get on television. It doesn't change overnight. And because people weren't willing to admit that we have these issues, the backlash of wanting to move forward, I think, has moved the needle back a little. But the net result is there are more people poised to move that needle forward, to move ahead. We knew that things would get crazy because change doesn't happen just because you ask politely. You have to shove a little bit. But I believe that we are on the right trajectory.
Well, not politely. It was justified anger. You right. caught flack just for writing that article,
you remember
right?
That. Yes.
I remember. Yes.
People just Alex,
how dare
you
be angry, Alex?
Right. Come on. You've got a doctorate. You live in Fitchburg. Right. How dare you be angry? Almost as if the success of a few of us then takes away the reality of systemic oppression and disparity. And so I refuse to be pushed into that category. I refuse to let the success that I've experienced and my family has experienced and my colleagues at the risk of those who are stuck by in a system that's broken. In fact, we need to keep pushing so that there are more people experiencing success in this community. And so, yeah, I got lots of flack from it. Why not call it justified action? You can still keep JA.
Right.
So people are telling me how to feel about right. what's happened to
You're
me.
You're not really angry.
Oh, no. That's what people want. Alex, it's not really that bad. You're not really that angry. In fact, the article starts off by someone congratulating me for not being an angry black man. And I asked her, why would you think I wasn't an angry black man?
Well, you're so nice.
Yes, right. You're so nice. Like I'm supposed to go to Rotary and jump up and down on the lectern. But my anger is not destructive. It actually propelled me to do different things in the community than what I had done before.
But calling it anger is what it needed to be called.
It's what it was.
Now that it's launched you into a passionate movement,
right.
that's great. But it's the anger. And so the fact of, in fact, that's what really drew me to it, too, was looking at this and saying, man, I just got to this town. This guy comes out and says I'm angry, and he's getting yelled at.
Right. Exactly. You know, I think... you know, if you just take a look at the relations of African-American people, black people in this country, historically.
Because really, Madison is just a microcosm.
Right. It's
right?
microcosm okay. of the rest of the United States. People never wanted slaves to be angry. They wanted the rape to not be called rape. They wanted it to be sort of a Nicholas Sparks love story. Hmm. Even Ancestry.com tries to paint that picture about blacks and whites back in, you know, post-Civil War. Do a jig, dance, smile, because people needed to believe that we were 3/5 of a person, that we weren't really human, that things didn't really hurt. You know, modern gynecology is based upon experiments that were done on black women's bodies without anesthesia, because the thought was these aren't really human beings. They're black beasts. And so it doesn't surprise me that people don't want me to be angry, because then that's too threatening. And that's to say that something's wrong with the system And they need, the system needs people like me to like the way things are because they can sleep at night. I don't give a care about people sleeping at night if they are involved in injustice.
And that's where you've been moving in and talking with this. But what's inspiring for you and I that brought us together is the education connection.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because this isn't, what you're doing through Justified Anger is educating.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. And educating you, and how to break systems. So not just filling our heads.
Right, right. It's
but,
not.
But, you know, I'm speaking to an educator. No, education that plays this stuff out in social action.
Because that's what, you know, so the African-American history course,
oh,
right? I mean,
yes.
There's so many things that you and I can talk about, but that's the one right now for Busted Pencils. You run an African-American history course.
Yes.
That has well over 600 people showing up, almost all white.
Well, each class can only hold 270.
Okay.
But this is our fifth cohort, so we've had over 1,200 go through the class. So we are maxed out in our facility at 270 because they break up in small groups of 10. So we have 27 small circles in my kitchen, at the church, in my office. I can't even use my office on Monday nights. But 270 white folks, mainly 99% white folks, who pay to come Monday nights for 2 hours to listen to UW, University of Wisconsin professors lecture about Western African history and African American history, and it is phenomenal.
So, and it's not just the lecture part, as you just said, though, they break into small groups. What's happening in those discussions? Is there pain?
Oh, there's pain, there's tears, there's anger, there's silence.
Okay.
It takes 40 volunteers to run this course.
Yeah.
So 27 facilitators, people helping with registration, and then even people who work in the parking lot, because once our parking lot's full, people park 3 blocks away at a bank and we shuttle them up the hill. We've done research to find that people are able to talk about these issues more easily if they're broken up. And we've been working with male and female groups around the same academic levels, around the same age, to really help to have some meaningful discussions. We have had some of the female participants say that the men have dominated discussions.
Mm.
We've had some men say that it wasn't as easy to talk about the issues when women were in the group. But I've noticed that when men, the white men, are in groups together, they're talking more because typically they're in a space where people of color are saying, well, you as a white man have experienced this. But what we find is that when they're in a room and it's just all white men, their guards are down a bit because they've all had that conversation or they've been the center of that conversation. And it allows a mirroring, personal mirroring, that enables them to really speak freely about that place of power, perceived and real power. So it really is disarming, particularly in the groups with white men.
See, that's interesting to think about that, but in one way I'm thinking about it, it might make sense because there's a sense of going, I'm not going to be judged
right. Or you've been told it too.
Right.
I've heard this. Have you guys heard this? Are you guys accused of this?
Because the first thing that pops to my mind is the possibility of 10 white guys sitting around going, we ain't that bad.
I don't think there would be someone in the group who would say, bullshit, yes, we are. Tell the truth.
Okay.
You're the CEO of this company. You said who you are. How many black people do you hire? How many black people do you? I mean, someone in that group would call them out. This is still Madison. So there's going to be some progressive, liberal, pseudo or otherwise in the group who's going to call it out. I think they feel that that's going to happen because they're pissed when we put them in those groups, because the white men will say, well, I want a black guy in my group because I can't learn about this. From white guys, you don't need to be in the group to learn about black history. You need to be in the group to learn about American history.
Right.
You need to talk about what white people did. And that's difficult because no one's ever said, you're white, this is your history, this is an issue, talk about it. No one's ever said it that way to them.
Is there any pushback, though? I mean, realistically?
Oh, yeah. People, okay. I mean, most people, I would say, Tim, you know, I do about a 10-minute monologue, and then I introduce the professor. It's a 4-person teaching team. And then that takes about an hour. So they have about 40 minutes in a small group. About 95% of the people go to their small groups. We watch them.
Mm-hmm.
A few will slip out. And sometimes it's not because they don't like the group. They might have a conflict.
Sure.
But there is some pushback. But what they realize is they aren't really given that space that's been granted to them in black-led space to talk about these issues, to rehash what they just heard about slavery or the transatlantic slave, you know, journey or the Middle Passage or Jim Crow. They've never been in space where they've heard that lecture and say, now go talk about it.
Right.
They've been in circles where they said, we've got to recruit more minorities. We've got to capitalize the being black. We've got to. But it's a different setup. And they realize you're here to learn. And if you push back, you only get what you put into it. So, I mean, I'm sure people sit and they don't talk. But for the most part, the people who do participate, they're finding that that is just as meaningful as the lecture.
Is there, when you're doing this, I mean, the movement, the idea too of essentially an African-American history course for white people to have this opportunity to push possibly on some really uncomfortable topics, the way you said that, the idea, I just try to imagine being in that group and saying, how do you address white privilege?
We have five more sessions, so I'd love you to be my guest and just sit in on the lecture on a Monday night. But what happens is the course is really, I designed it with Professor Stephen Kantrowitz, who's a history professor at UW-Madison. But he also has appointments in the Afro-American History Department and also American Indian Studies. And he's a Jewish man who just has happened upon this area of history. But I said, Steve, this has got to be a U.S. history course that focuses on Black history.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not a Black history course because people will think they don't have to come. Let's find out what was going on in America that made Americans say, hey, let's build a ship. Let's go to Africa. Let's do this, this, and that. Let's become a world superpower and grow sugar and molasses and export rum and cotton, et cetera, et cetera. What was going on in America that made that possible?
Mm-hmm.
So then what happens is there's an understanding of systems and laws and rules, i.e. the Constitution, and things that were established in the country that made it very easy to oppress people.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't even have to talk about white privilege as we're shaping or talking about the shaping of the Constitution. Who could own property? I mean, who could vote?
Mm-hmm.
White men with property. I mean, that's wealth, that's gender, that's ethnicity. They are smart enough to say, oh my gosh, that's the white privilege people are talking about.
Why? I learned this, though, in third grade, in fifth grade, in seventh grade, in eighth grade, in 11th grade, in college. Why? And I'm just saying, what went wrong?
Where did you grow up, out east?
I grew up in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
So it could be the teachers. It could be a number of things. I didn't learn that. I had never.
So you're
heard
saying your experience of learning history, we'll just say it,
right,
is the same as mine. Bad.
Bad. So I had never even heard the phrase Harlem Renaissance until I was in college in a class being taught by Professor Nellie McKay. I came home and I asked my mother, I said, there are pictures of Black folks in long trench coats, leather coats and fancy hats in uptown New York. What happened?
Mm.
And she said, integration, baby. That's what she said. She said, integration.
But you had there was not.
I had never heard of Harlem Renaissance. I just thought we went from slavery to sharecropping to I have a dream speech, and now we're trying to get it together. I didn't know that during Reconstruction, nearly 2,000 Black people were voted into some level of political position.
Right.
I didn't know that 16 men had been elected to Congress.
The progress.
To the U.S. Senate. One of those branches of government. I don't want to get it wrong, but one of those. But 16 men.
Right.
It's a book by Philip Dre that's called Capital Men. We don't have that today.
No.
And so I didn't know that. I would have approached life differently had I known that what we're doing when I was growing up in the 60s and 70s was not trailblazing.
But I think about what I was taught, and I was taught about the triangle trade. I was taught about slavery. It was never put in the context of, do you understand as a white person how this system might still be in place today?
And how it might benefit you.
And how, right. It happened. You learned about it. I took my test. I drew my triangle on the map.
Right.
And I moved on then to George Washington.
Exactly. So that you could continue to perpetuate a system of injustice. We weren't taught that we were taught that people were slaves, that somehow they found themselves in slavery. No, there were Africans who were enslaved.
Right.
But it sounds like some mean people captured folks, but then some nice white people freed them. But what you don't realize is people who built the railroads and barrel makers and people who made and drank rum, people who sold rum, were all supporting the slave system because slaves were in the Caribbean, you know, on sugarcane farms, you know, making molasses that was turned to rum that made America a super world power. We weren't taught that we became a super world power on stolen land and raped bodies. And so we just think we pulled ourselves up by our bootstraps, and that's why we're better than everybody else in the world. And most people don't even understand what we did to people in order to become a superpower.
To become, yeah, I mean, in one way, to get the white privilege
right.
I had was built on the back of
exactly.
minority.
Exactly.
Stolen land, as you said.
Right.
Stolen labor, stolen childhood, stolen, right. stolen lives.
Stolen babies.
Stolen babies, all of that. And that, I guess that's the part, you know, when I wanted to have you on for the show for Busted Pencils, to put that out there is, as we talk about history and education, I've always wanted this show to push the boundaries of education.
Sure.
To say, no, it's not about, as you said, telling me things and I tell you it back.
Right.
But how do you transform my soul?
Right.
Right. And so what you're doing with that, I think about this all the time. And I just remember one of the other times I saw you speak when you talked about the fact of you contextualize how close slavery still was
right.
in reality, as opposed to a past transgression that had been fixed.
Exactly. It's never been fixed.
It's not.
You know, Tim, I was talking with one of my mentors who's a thought leader in the area of education, Dr. Gloria Latson Billings. And she said to me, Alice, you have to keep in mind that even when integration happened, 36,000 black teachers lost their jobs. Mm. And I said, Dr. Gloria, I never thought about that. She said, the teachers weren't integrated. The teachers didn't go into the white school. Little Rock 9, you didn't see them with their black teachers behind them.
Oh, man.
The kids were integrated. And in some cases, those teachers became domestics. Many of them wanted to become chemists, but DuPont wasn't hiring them. And so people with master's degrees in botany, in chemistry, taught in high schools, black women and black men. So black people actually had a better education in some schools because their teachers weren't just general science mm-hmm. teachers, but they had masters in botany, biology, chemistry. When those students went into the white schools, taking with them money to fund those schools, many of those white women started cleaning white people's toilets. And you're in education. What's the big cry today? Where are the black students in education?
Where are the teachers? Right. Where are the teachers? And this is a remnant.
This is a remnant. And education is how we lifted ourselves out of discrimination.
Or we keep ourselves in it, depending on who's controlling education.
Sure.
That's why I want, because what you're doing with Nehemiah, with Justified Anger, is taking back control of that narrative.
Right.
And that's where it's, because, you know, what was taught to me as education and history mm-hmm. didn't do anything other than give me a story of the past.
And it robbed my soul because I didn't see myself in the world,
right.
only in chains, only with a bone in my nose. That's all I saw. I didn't know about the contributions. I didn't know about the won elections. I didn't know about the inventions. And so history and education in general was a place where I felt isolated, invisible. And the educational system demeaned me. It didn't build me up. It demeaned me because I didn't see what it had to do with black people. I had maybe 3 black teachers in my entire life. The chair of the AFRAM department at the university when I was in it was white. He was a good professor. He was my advisor, Bill Vandenberg. I loved Professor Vandenberg. But a white man was the chair of the African American right. History Department. And so I remember once I went to college with my mother. We took 3 classes together, and she was in that department also. She raised her hand in Professor Vandenberg's class and said, you know, I'm tired of, he was giving this gruesome thing about how a pregnant woman was being torn apart. Each leg was tied to a horse and all these things that would happen. They would dig holes in the ground and put the woman's pregnant belly in it so they could still flog her. She said, I'm tired of you telling me what black people endured. I need you to tell me what the hell were white people thinking doing this to people? What type of inhumane sickness would cause someone to inflict this upon a pregnant person, not even a dog or a gerbil, but on a person. And he just got quiet because the subject matter was around what was done to us. Mm-hmm. She said, take me into the psyche of your people. Take me into the psyche of those people. What happens in you that makes you that sick? And how do we become pagan? How do we become the ones who are animals when you can do that to human beings? And he answered it in some way, but that's the real question. The real question is not what they did, but it's why they did it And what stopped it? At what point did someone hit a reset button and say, we don't see you that way anymore, and we don't act that way anymore? When did that happen? When did we have a kumbaya moment? So Charlottesville doesn't shock me. These events, you know, Dylann Roof shooting up a church doesn't shock me, because we assumed, because of JFK, RFK, MLK, Malcolm X, that these things just change and you can't legislate attitudes. You've got to find a way to educate, re-educate, and build relationship and trust with people.
When I appreciate the relationship and trust you and I've been building over the last 7 years. So Black Like Me, where can I find it?
You know, iTunes,
Spotify.
Stitcher, Spotify.
Just type in blacklikeme.com.
Yes. In fact, if you it's interesting. If you have an iPhone or iOS, you can say, Siri, find Black Like Me. Google users or Android users can say, hey, Google, find Black Like Me. Just type in Black Like Me on any of the platforms, or people can go to alexgee.com and find it. But it's an exciting, unfiltered podcast where I talk with guests about what life is like as a Black individual navigating a white world.
Well, Alex, friend, Reverend Doctor.
All those.
All those things. Thanks for busting pencils.
Oh, man. I appreciate the opportunity to sit here with you. This is really, it's been an honor.
Thank you, Alex.
Sure. Thank you.
Hey, this is Tim from Rise Against here on Busted Pencils Radio.
Time now for our weekly salute to legendary historian and activist Howard Zinn. This is your moment of Zen.
A good education is a synthesis of book learning and involvement in social action, because each enrich the other. The accumulation of knowledge, while fascinating in itself, is not sufficient without action.
My thanks to Reverend Dr. Alex G. You, the listener, make sure you rate, subscribe, and share this podcast. I'm Dr. Tim Slecker. Thanks for busting pencils.
Log on to bustedpencils.com for the latest trending news, blogs, past shows, and more. Subscribe to our podcast in iTunes and Google Play. And get daily updates by following us on Facebook and Twitter at Busted Pencils. This is Fully Leaded Education Talk. Busted Pencils Radio.